Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today we bring you Ernie Jolly. Ernie is the Associate Vice President of the Mortgage Bankers Association. And we met Ernie when we were interviewing Marcus Mason, who is a friend and a mentor to Ernie. And at that time, Ernie and I talked after the interview, and I said, at some point in the future, we're going to have to sit down and do an interview. Ernie is a graduate of Cornell, graduated in the top of his class, near the top of his class, cum laude, went on to law school, and has had a number of fellowships, which I'm going to ask him about. And he worked on the Hill before he started his current job. So Ernie, I don't know how many Cornell graduates we've had. I think we've had one, maybe two, but welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here. As we've discussed in the past, I am a subscriber to the podcast. I listen to your show. I find it very insightful. So it's an honor for me to be here.
Well, thank you, Ernie. It's great to have you here. And, you know, now I think Marcus, you know, although he was supportive, he was a little concerned about us having an Alpha Phi Alpha member. Now, what fraternity was Marcus? I can't remember.
Yeah, Marcus is a member of Omega Psi Phi. And I am a member of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated, both of which are historically African-American universities. Alpha Phi Alpha is the first, though. It's the first African-American fraternity. And it was founded at Cornell University, where I attended college. So I happened to be not only a part of the first African-American fraternity, but the first chapter therein. So something I'm super proud of, but still have love for Marcus. He's certainly a mentor and someone I look up to.
Well, that was obvious watching you two interact and joke about that. And now Alpha Phi Alpha has played a significant role in your life, has it not? And how is that?
For sure. Alpha Phi Alpha at Cornell exposed me to a host of African-American professionals in various industries, in architecture, in the legal industry, but also a lot of folks in the policy area as well. So I developed a lot of mentors through membership in the fraternity, but also the fraternity, because of the historic role it's played in the civil rights movement, puts a premium on ensuring its members develop leadership skills that would allow them to be useful to the larger African-American community. So whether that's oratorical contests, I participated in them through the fraternity. Our Voteless People is a Hopeless People campaign is one that is focused on registering folks to vote and getting them out to the polls, all of which I had the pleasure of participating in as an undergraduate student. And a lot of that I take with me today in the work that I do in the policy space. So Alpha Phi Alpha, in addition to a lot of other organizations, played a very important role in that development. And I certainly give them credit for where I am today.
Yeah, Marcus made that clear also. And how did you come to meet Marcus Mason?
So that's a funny story. He probably doesn't remember, but I was interested in the Congressional Black Caucuses Foundation's fellowship program. At the time, it was my last year in law school, and I was looking at different opportunities. I was familiar with the CBCF fellowship program because when I did my initial internship on Capitol Hill with Adolphus Towns back in 08, during the summer of the financial crisis, I had the opportunity of interacting with a gentleman named Virgil Miller, who's now a lobbyist with Akin Gump. And at the time, he was coming out of the fellowship. And I always looked at it as a potential opportunity after graduate school. Luckily, the opportunity was still there. And I went to the CBCF's board of directors or advisory council list. I forget which one Mason is on. I believe it's the corporate advisory council. And I noticed his name and I reached out, did a cold email, and he said, come on in, let's talk. And it was interesting. I don't know if he tried to intimidate me because I was an alpha, but he had his feet on the desk and really pressured me on, you know, speaking up. I was generally I'm a very low-key, shy person, but I do remember that meeting with Marcus. He was very adamant about me speaking up more, and I take that lesson with me till this day. I appreciate him so much for that.
So you graduated. While you were at Cornell, you had a summer fellowship at the U.S. Department of Labor. That must have been interesting. How did you come to that program?
Yeah, for sure. I credit that experience to a gentleman named Bill Keyes. He's actually an African-American Republican, but he started an organization in the early 2000s called the Institute for Responsible Citizenship. And the goal of that program was to take African-Americans who are at the top of their class in various colleges, bring them to D.C., place them in various paid internships, which is very important because a lot of folks can't afford coming to D.C. for free. So he placed them in paid internships and also allowed them to take courses. So it's a two-summer program, and it still goes on today, and I'm very active as an alum. During my first summer, I had the opportunity to work with the Department of Labor, particularly in its division that deals with contractors and their compliance with various labor laws, while taking courses at Georgetown in economic principles and constitutional law. And the second summer, I was able to work with my then hometown congressman, Adolphus Towns. And if you recall, that was the summer of 2008, which is right at the start of the financial crisis. That experience was a tremendous one. It was eye-opening because you had a kid, me, coming from an area in Brooklyn, Bedford-Stuyvesant, that was hardest hit by the financial crisis. But I had this opportunity to be in a space of power where folks were making very important policy decisions on how to best provide assistance to these communities and support our economy. So I was able to get an inside look at that process. But at the end of the internship, I went home and I saw the same foreclosure signs on homes that, you know, other kids in my neighborhood saw. So I was able to see two perspectives, two very different perspectives in one summer. And that made me think I need to eventually come back to D.C. and find a way to work on the Hill. This could potentially be a way to kind of, you know, have fun with whatever I do, because I find policy interesting, but also do something of purpose that has significance to the communities that, you know, I grew up in.
And so your next venture on the Hill was as a tax policy research intern with the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct. So that was during law school. So I went to law school at American University, but I knew I didn't want to become a lawyer. When I was interning with Adolphus Towns, I noticed all these people that were coming in and out of the office. And I noticed that, you know, they were having meetings with the member of Congress and his staff. And I always wondered what they did. So I, as a kid that was intern that was answering the phones, I would always get their cards. But I would save those cards and read their bios. And I kind of mapped out a career trajectory for myself by looking at those experiences. And a lot of these folks had law degrees. So I said, I'll come to DC and get a law degree. But my plan was never really to practice law. And coming to American University, Washington College of Law, it was almost the perfect decision because they had so much opportunities for people who wanted to get into the legislative process. So, for example, my professor that taught a legislative process course was Jamie Raskin. This was before he was a member of Congress. He was actually, I believe, the speaker for the Maryland House, but that was part-time. He was a full-time law professor. And that's just a glimpse of the exposure that I got at WCL. But to your point, I did an internship with the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. It's a think tank founded by African-Americans focused on issues pertaining to African-American communities. And I did tax-related research for a Social Security expert named Wilhelmina Lay. I credit her, too, for my development and love for these types of issues. So she had me write in a host of blogs, all of which she edited and eventually published under my name, that really provided me a unique opportunity to develop a portfolio that I could then take to offices on Capitol Hill and say, hire me. This is all of the, you know, work I've done in the policy space, and tax is something that I eventually kind of focused on, not only through the internships that I did, but also in the coursework I took at American. My tax professor, Andrew Pike, really encouraged me to like delve into tax. I got my first A in tax and just decided to continue down that road and took all the tax courses at American as a result, because I just kept getting A's and everything else I was getting B's. So I figured, let me just stick to tax. And it kind of just happened to work out serendipitously. And then everything kind of just fell in line, and I'm doing work today that's very similar. As you know, there's a lot of mortgage related issues that have tax implications. So.
Right. Well, it must have worked, because you ultimately had some great jobs, full-time jobs on the Hill. Tell our listeners, I got to tell you, Ernie, I haven't had too many people tell me that tax was their favorite class that they performed best at in law school. That's fantastic. And tell us about your full-time work on the Hill.
Yeah, on the Hill, I got my first, I would say, professional opportunities that weren't merely internships through the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. Like I mentioned, they do that 2-year fellowship program that I learned about when I was initially an intern. They created a financial services fellowship, and I was the inaugural fellow there, and had an opportunity to do my fellowship with Congressman Gregory Meeks from New York. He represents parts of Queens, actually a district where my dad has worked for over 20 years as a mechanic. So I was very familiar with the district, even though I didn't live there.
You grew up in Brooklyn?
Correct. Brooklyn, okay. And Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Okay.
And Mr. Meeks is a senior Democrat on the committee. He's currently the chair of the Subcommittee on Consumer Protection and Financial Institutions. He's also vying to become the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee. But that really, I was really like pushed in the water from the start and was expected to learn how to swim doing that job, which was a wonderful experience for me. So from the jump, even as a fellow, was helping him prepare for financial services hearings and such. And I just really developed a love for these issues, partly because of they were intellectually stimulating, but also because of real impact some of the issues that fall under that committee have for communities of color and other underserved communities. So that's where I got my start. The second half of the fellowship, I did it with the Senate Finance Committee. And that was interesting timing as well. During that time, there was a heated debate around a Department of Labor rule, aka the fiduciary rule. And that had jurisdiction not only in the Senate Labor Committee, but also under Senate Finance. So I was able to work with Kara Goetz, who person I really appreciate. She was a counsel for the Finance Committee, as well as Tiffany Smith. But she really allowed me to take a lead on drafting some of the first comment letters that the committee wrote on that rule. Really gave me some great exposure there. And I did it briefly and left the fellowship a little bit early to eventually go to the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, which was a full-time job off the Hill.
Yeah. And so you have experience on, you're one of those people that have experience on both the House and the Senate side. How are they different for those of our listeners that haven't worked on the Hill?
Yeah, I personally have a preference for the House. I think if you have issues just focusing on one issue, you don't have that problem in the House, because there's so many different things coming at you. In the Senate, I just find that, you know, folks are more specialists and really focused on very nuanced, discrete issues. So their issue may come up or may not, if that makes sense. So it's just a different kind of environment. I just feel like it's a lot more coming at you in the House, and I just preferred that kind of environment. So when I decided to eventually come back to the Hill in a full-time role as LD, I did want to come to the House, and eventually got back to the office of Congressman Meeks, where I did his financial services work, but as a full-time staffer.
Yeah. What did you like most about that job, being legislative director? And you were also, I think, deputy chief of staff in that office also, right?
Correct.
What did you like most about your work during that time?
Yeah, so having that fellowship experience where I was able to work on comment letters and then eventually going to the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, where I helped them in particular comment letters. That experience allowed me to really be productive in Meeks's office as LD, because we were in a minority at the time. And we were getting some bills passed because Mr. Meeks has really strong relationships on the other side of the aisle. But generally speaking, you know, we couldn't push forth all our legislative priorities, but what we could do is write comment letters. So I did a lot of letters, and the experiences I had before kind of put me in the best position to get that done. And I would say that was my favorite part of that job. We really had to be entrepreneurial because we were in a minority, and find unique ways to get legislative wins, even if that doesn't mean actually passing a bill. And that experience I take with me today, even as a lobbyist, because you kind of have to always think outside of the box. And that experience prepped me for that. But it was indeed my favorite part of the job. I would say second favorite part was, you know, just being on the inside. Being a lobbyist now, you're on the outside. You don't get information as much. But actually working on the Hill, you have access to just so much information that you often take for granted. And I do miss that a whole lot.
Yeah, getting timely, accurate information is a big challenge of our work. And I've often heard that from people who have worked on the Hill and then, you know, now work on the outside, how they miss how easy it is to find out what's going on and what people are saying and doing. Mm-hmm. And was it fun working on the Hill? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was certainly fun. I would say working on the Hill was the best job I've had in my very, you know, young career. The exposure was great, but the feeling that I was in a work that had a direct impact on my family and folks in my community, that by far made it very meaningful to me. And I don't think I'll ever get that experience doing other things, but we'll see. I'm still relatively young, so we'll see what the future has in store. But I don't know if there's any other profession where you could be that young and have that much connection to folks of power and influence in things like policy that has ramifications for, you know, the whole country. I mean, it's an awesome kind of opportunity for a young person. So I would recommend all my mentees and folks that I still mentor at Cornell, including folks in Alpha, to consider that as a possibility. Even if you don't want to, you know, do what I do today, there's space for everyone. I mean, if you want to be a doctor, when you do your, you know, gap year, maybe consider working on the Hill and working for the Science Committee and or the ENC Committee, which has jurisdiction over health issues. And again, that experience could kind of inform, you know, a lot of what you do later in other sectors. So it's something I advocate for, especially among some of my mentees.
Well, Ernie, I think although you did have, it was a tremendous opportunity and you had incredible influence and access to power, I think you're going to find that you have tremendous influence and impact going forward with all the mentoring work you do, the engagement. Who knows, you may find yourself back on the Hill again at some point, maybe running for office. I think the way that you engage different people, the little bit of exposure I've had to you, I think people like you can make a tremendous impact.
I appreciate that, Jim.
Well, and so it also, it's kind of interesting to think about how you talked about how your office worked across the aisle. And even though, I mean, I know we always feel like the times that we're in are the most partisan, and I have to admit it, it does feel that way right now. But I heard, you know, in the documentary on Justice Ginsburg, President Clinton was quoted there talking about that I think Ginsburg had 96 or 97 votes in the Senate in favor. And President Clinton pointed out that it was, in fact, pretty partisan times back then. I mean, and we kind of forget that. And it's interesting to hear you talk about, you know, working across the aisle. So although that's not the headlines, it seems like it was continuing to go on, at least back then.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that happens very often. We don't see it as much on the television, but it does happen. My hope is that it continues to flourish, that bipartisanship. And we kind of see that through caucuses like the Problem Solvers Caucus, which was created over the past few years to bring folks together on both sides of the aisle to deal with issues that are often wedge issues. So you even see it with this current coronavirus relief effort. That group came out with a bipartisan proposal to kind of get around the current logjam there. So I think that'll continue. And we just have to find a way of getting that message out to the public. All the good work that does happen behind the scenes that isn't necessarily the most sexiest of things to put on television or your local radio. So that's my hope.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what the best thing that could happen is the people who are part of that Problem Solvers Caucus and others who work in a bipartisan manner, if they continue to win elections because of that, I think that would go a long way in helping.
For sure. For sure.
And now you are at the Mortgage Bankers Association. How long have you been there and how are you all dealing with the COVID crisis?
Yeah. So I've been with the Mortgage Bankers Association for around a year and a half, and I focus on engaging House Democrats. It's been a challenging year, largely because of the current economic and health crises that we are in the midst of, but it has been fulfilling work. So you mentioned the pandemic. As you know, housing plays an outsized role in our economy. And naturally, our industry is impacted by the current crisis. So over the past couple of months, the industry has been able to put over 4 million Americans in forbearance plans. And forbearance plans don't just end by consumers delaying their payments. Someone has to step up and make those payments on behalf of the borrower to investors, because we have a unique housing finance system in the U.S. where investors play an important role. So that's what our industry did. We put over 4 million people in forbearance plans, but also stepped up and made those payments on their behalf to investors. So you could imagine what kind of financial strain that could create for the system. Luckily, the mortgage industry learned a lot during the 08 crisis. There were some lessons learned there that I think put the industry in a much better place to really support the economy as Americans weather the current financial storm. So I'm proud of the work we've done to provide economic relief to Americans, but also the work we've done with legislators to ensure that there's liquidity in the system and that there isn't an uneven recovery when things start to pick back up, because that's a major concern for many, how our recovery looks, who benefits and who doesn't, and whether or not inequality would expand as a result of an uneven recovery. So we're very engaged in those conversations. We've started a affordable housing initiative last year that's playing a very important role in those conversations. And we also started a Black home ownership initiative that we're thinking through different policies to close that wealth gap amongst African Americans. Right now, the Black home ownership rate is such that it's similar to the rate when the Fair Housing Act was passed in the 60s. So that's something that's of concern to the industry, and we're exploring ways of addressing that as well. So I'm very proud of the work that we've been able to do despite the challenges, including our current health and economic crises. And I think you're going to see the mortgage industry playing a very important role toward helping folks get back on their feet post-pandemic.
That's great. And you said, Ernie, I can't imagine what the financial commitment has been to help those 4 million homeowners and forbearance, but that's great. And boy, next year, you know, once this election is over and, you know, hopefully an effective vaccine comes out soon, and hopefully next year we'll begin to get back to a more normal type of environment. But Ernie, it has been great to have you on the podcast. I'm mm-hmm. so glad I got to meet you when we were sitting down with Marcus. And I'm glad we were able to finally do this. And we're going to put your contact info in our notes. So anybody, any young person out there looking for a little advice or thoughts on how to approach law school, how to approach internships, how to approach a fellowship, how to approach Capitol Hill, please feel free to reach out to Ernie. He is incredibly thoughtful and will be very helpful. And it's just been great to have you on the show, Ernie.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Man, I'll be more than willing to help whoever reaches out. I think I've been able to get to where I am because there were people like the Marcus Masons of the world that looked out for me. There were investments that folks made in nonprofits, like many of the ones I mentioned, like the Institute for Responsible Citizenship. So by no means am I confused on how I've been able to be successful here. I know it's because of other people and the time they put in mentoring me, the doors they opened before I got here, but also the investments that governmental and private folks made in programs that kind of provided me the exposure that I wouldn't have gotten otherwise. So I'll be more than willing to help. And I appreciate you, Jim, for giving me this opportunity to speak with you.
Well, it's, you know, we all need that help and we need that mentoring. And, you know, you wouldn't be where you were today if it was not for your, you know, your hard work and how you approached it and a combination of that with the mentoring. So it's important to continue that on. And I know you're very, very committed to doing that. So you're welcome and thank you. So, and for all our listeners out there, remember you can follow us on social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. You can also sign up for our Monday morning email at thepoliticallife.net. Comes out, you guessed it, every Monday morning with the podcast. Little tidbits in there you may find helpful. And we hope you are all staying safe during this COVID crisis. And we hope you have a good week, and we will see you next Monday.